This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Your first year of life was critical for how your brain is wired. In that first year, if it was chaotic, unpredictable, if there was trauma, then that impacted your ability to learn, develop relationships, and have stable life patterns. This is true for all children, and we're learning more about this every day. So what does this mean for children who are in rocky homes today? Children who see violence, experience food and housing insecurity, and other trauma. What treatment is available to help these children deal with their trauma and develop powerful and beneficial life patterns? We invite you to call in as we talk about the impact of trauma on children's brains. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this afternoon by Bruce Perry. He's a psychiatrist and international trauma expert, a senior fellow with the Child Trauma Academy. Also with us is Diana Ochoa-Johnson, the chief clinical officer for the Children's Shelter of San Antonio, and Ryan Hamilton and Michelle Justice Hamilton. They are caregivers of two children that they have now brought into their home and their parenting, and we can hear a little bit more about that situation later on. But welcome all y'all to The Source. It's great to have you here this afternoon. So Bruce Perry, you wrote the book, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. What is that? Talk about that.
First of all, thank you for having me on. It's an honor, and I'm looking forward to some conversation. The book, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, is a set of clinical experiences that I had as I was developing as a psychiatrist, where I learned something from the child or the family I was working with that helped change the way I thought about the impact of trauma on development. And you know, these are clinical vignettes that started about 30, 35 years ago. And at that time, our field, you know, the broad field of mental health, child welfare, we were not that well informed about the impact of trauma on development. And over the last 30 years, we've learned a lot more, and we still have much to learn, but we have basically change the way we understand development and its impact on individuals. And it's, as you pointed out in the introduction, one of the most important things we've learned is these early developmental experiences have really, really profound impact on how our brain organizes, and then that in turn influences the way we think, feel, and behave. And it also has impact, as I'm sure we'll talk about, on our physical health, because so many of the systems in the brain and body that are involved in managing stress become altered through these developmental trauma, and then because of those alterations, it changes the way we regulate our heart and our pancreas and our gut and other parts of our body.
I've always thought about it this way with children, small children, that they have a window that will open up, you know, from time to time, and that window will just devour information, and it's their learning window. And but if the child is dealing with stress, uncertainty, insecurity, an environment that is not pleasant, that window will either open for very, very small or won't open at all, not as open as wide or for as long as the child is in a happy environment.
I think that that's a one way to look at it, and I think in many ways that's true. The good news about some of the research that has been going on in the last few years is that we're realizing that these windows can be, if you will, pried open again. And if we do the right things developmentally, we have an opportunity to help these kids catch up in ways that allow them, not always, but in many cases, to move towards normal in their functioning. And the key to that, the key to opening those windows and recapturing some of the developmental potential is relationships, that children who have present, attentive, attuned, and responsive adults in their life, whether that's a parent, a neighbor, a coach, a teacher, these relationships become the vehicle for healing.
Diana Ochoa Johnson, Chief Clinical Officer for the Children's Shelter of San Antonio. For the children that come to your facility, the children that you're dealing with, frequently they've seen and they've experienced incredible trauma and uncertainty and chaos, unpredictability, and now you've got to deal with them. You got to help them. What do you do?
That's exactly right. Well, the first thing we do is we assess them as quickly as we can, and by that I mean we do a thorough mental health assessment. We get them in front of one of our therapists just as quickly as they come to our doors, and then we do a trauma assessment. And included in that is, you know, we try to get as clear and complete of a trauma history as we can on the child. So we really want to know what's happened to this child, and that's kind of one of the key questions that we want to ask and we want some answers for. And then after that, we start therapy, and we have our therapists who are all trained in some evidence-based model of trauma treatment, so they have an understanding of trauma and its effects, and then we begin to intervene with interventions that we know to be effective.
And so what we're talking about now was children who have gone through this trauma. Trust is a big part of it, rebuilding that trust. And so is that the first thing you try to establish?
Absolutely. The first thing we try to establish is some safety. And when I mean safety, I'm not talking simply about physical safety, because once they come into our doors at the children's shelter, they are physically safe. No one's going to hurt them any longer, and their needs are going to be met. But beyond that, we want our children to feel emotionally safe, for what we call felt safety. And for some children, that takes an awfully long time. You know, we may be trying to provide them a safe environment, but that doesn't mean that they feel safe. That takes time, and that's assisted, as Dr. Perry mentioned, by establishing some consistent and nurturing relationships, people that they can count on, and slowly and surely they begin to establish some of that trust.
And these developments of the neuroscience of learning and the impact of trauma in that area and the how this hurts the brain development. So are y'all taking that to heart at the children's shelter?
Absolutely. So we see a lot of delays often with these children, developmental delays. Some of them may be speech delayed. Sometimes we even see delays in their physical development. You know, they're not very coordinated at times. And so we immediately try to wrap those kind of therapies around them too, you know, get them in front of a speech therapist as soon as possible if that's what the need is, or an occupational therapist or a physical therapist, someone that can help them start to make some gains in those areas in which they're showing some delays.
Right, but then the cause of those delays are the impact of the trauma, and so trying to address that would be dealing with the root cause. And if they're still dealing with the negative impact, the heavy cloud, the weight of all that trauma, it's going to be very difficult for them to pick up on the benefits of the therapy, because that frontal cortex is still not absorbing the information that's being presented to them.
That's right. And so this is not something that's going to happen overnight. And that's something that's very important for people to understand. You know, for some of these children, it's going to take them days, if not weeks or months, before they're even able to talk even a little bit about what has happened to them.
So we're going to talk more about that. Also, this is information I think is beneficial to all parents, talking about how to, you know, present issues, how to act in front of your children, especially one-year-olds, children, babies. They pick up on all this. It impacts them. Our number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. More on The Source when we come back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A child's exposure to stress, chaos, unpredictability has a dramatic, profound, and long-lasting impact on that child's ability to learn, adapt, and develop stable patterns of life. How to help children get over trauma that they experienced as infants and then growing up through life, and how all children could benefit from acknowledging the fact that they need stability, they need to have that feeling of being loved and knowing that that they have an element of control over their life. You can call and tell your story, share your opinions. Let's hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Now, let's turn to Ryan Hamilton, Michelle Justice Hamilton. They are relative caregivers, two children that have been brought into their house that they're now parenting, and who have gone through some of this trauma and who are now receiving treatment And so, Ryan, do you want to tell us about what happened?
Yes. Well, it turns out that my brother, which is where my two nephews have come from and are now with us, was losing his apartment. He was being evicted. And he doesn't have a job and all this sort of stuff. And he isn't able to support his children. And they were living on the streets, so they needed somewhere to go. And so we basically were able to get this through my mom to get him out here so that we could take care of them and help them out. So in regards, there was a lot of stress at the house. There was the stress of him and his girlfriend fighting. And then all kinds of other things that were not happening, not getting enough food at sometimes, et cetera, et cetera. So they were pretty much going into a homeless type situation, which wasn't good for them.
So you could see as a child, and we're talking about, they're not children, infants, they were, you know, adolescents.
Yes.
And so
close to it. So the one nephew was 17 at the time and the other one was 11. And then the daughter was around 12.
And the daughter's gone off to a different household.
Yes, the daughter's with my dad.
So what happened the day those kids came to your house?
The first day they came to my house, they didn't really want to be there. But the oldest one was okay with it. Actually, he wanted to get away. But the youngest one was, I don't know why I have to leave. Why can't I just stay with them? And et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, you have a roof over your head instead of living in a car and all that sort of thing. So that kind of made a big difference for him. He started seeing that, yeah, you're right. And pretty much it made me feel better knowing that they had a roof over their head and they were actually in a more stable environment than where they were.
Well, we've already heard from Bruce Perry. Is that relationships are key. So how are you building a relationship with these two?
So the building of the relationship hasn't been easy considering.
Because they're going to test you.
Considering that they were used to different rules and systems with their parents and with my grandpa, with their grandpa, excuse me. And so, yes, they wanted to test their abilities to get the things that they want or not the things that they don't want. And, you know, when it comes to doing homework, that's still a struggle, trying to get them to do homework rather than just wanting to play games all the time and do other things that, or to escape it, those types of things.
And Michelle?
Definitely, it was a big issue. He would always just want to be playing his on the phone all the time because that's what he got to do before. The same day he came in, we gave him a limit. So we wanted to have him have structure. We had him have a bedtime that's a certain time every night. We had him take showers certain days because he wasn't used to having any kind of structure. So, you know, we started out doing those things, and I believe it really helped.
Have you made him any promises? Have you promised him that you're going to be there and love him
yes.
forever?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
How do you think that was received?
Over the first year, he wasn't really receiving much because he was very upset. He couldn't focus. There was always something. He wasn't happy. He was very stressed. And I think he started realizing over time that the environment was a little bit more stable and it helped him to relax a little bit. And there was a few other things that helped too, including the Hope Center, his constant talking. I know he spent a long time where he wouldn't tell him anything, but it really got us to realize how messed up in his head he is.
So let's talk about the services that are available and the services that you've been able to take advantage here in San Antonio. You mentioned the Hope Center, and that's the Harvey Najim Hope Center that we have here in San Antonio. And what kind of services have you received?
So we got recommended. I took him for a physical and everything, and then also the doctor referred me to their doctor, who's a psychiatrist. And so we visited with her, and the same day that we went in there, he would not speak to her. I explained everything, you know, the situation where he came from and all that. And he, the minute you tried to get him to talk, he would just start crying. So what she told us, she goes, I know this place that would be wonderful for him to go to. I want you to go ahead and contact them and follow up with them. And ever since that was it, that's the Hope Center. So we called them. I went in. Exactly what they were, what he was talking about, what you were saying. You know, they did the assessment. We filled out a lot of paperwork, but but it's okay. You know, we want them to get a clear picture of what's going on, and then they also we met as a family, like my husband and I and his older brother and him. We were all in the room. It was very awkward, I will tell you that, because they know stuff that we don't. We want to do whatever we can to help them. But, you know, Rosemary, she was, you know, she just kind of walked us through.
That's and, a therapist?
Yeah. She's a therapist at the Hope Center. And she's been our saving grace, I'll just tell you that.
Like, what does she do?
She's the director, I believe.
Clinical director,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, clinical director for the Hope Center.
So how has she been your saving grace? Like, tell me.
So, you know, she's the one that, the 11-year-old went to counseling every week for almost 2 years. Some days we had to miss, but for the most part, so if we ever had a situation, we would just call and say, can we come on in? And, you know, the 11-year-old is having a difficult time of dealing with the situation. So, you know, and towards the end, just like recently, we had a situation where he was having a really hard time, and we went in there, and it made, you could see the total transformation. It was just amazing. Like, he, in the very beginning, when we first took him to counseling, he would hardly talk. But at the end, like just a few months ago, he was just talking about everything, you know, about his family situation, about what he had and what he hadn't before. And so it really made such a tremendous difference.
No, go ahead. So Ryan, have you seen this transformation?
Yes.
At home?
And also, too, I mean, she spent so many weeks with him where he would yell and scream and do all kinds of crazy stuff about, I'm not talking to you, you're just crazy, and blah, 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 and just all that kind of, it was, and then all of a sudden, it was that one day, all that patience, all that, she got him to open up, and it was just amazing to watch it.
So let me go to Bruce Perry, psychiatrist and international trauma expert, and a senior fellow at the Child Trauma Academy. What are you hearing here, Bruce?
Well, I think this is actually a really pretty classic illustration of the challenge of getting some of these kids into a trusting relationship, and that the persistence and the patience of the therapist was ultimately something that was able to break through that apprehension that this child had about trusting somebody. And I think, you know, again, you've been talking about this, but one of the hardest challenges in all of this work is maintaining a trusting relationship, because a lot of these kids have had losses and they've had people that have come in and out of their lives. And, you know, in this case, it has not happened, which is great. But a lot of these kids end up having 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 placements. And every time they come into a placement, the foster carers will usually very honestly make the promises that they're invested in this child and that they're there for the long run and that they're going to be consistent and predictable. And the behaviors of the child, kind of like the Hamiltons have been describing, frequently leads adults to give up or push them away. And So children will act out like that in school, and they get kicked out of school. They act out like that with friends, and then people that are theoretical friends or potential friends say, I don't want to hang out with that kid. And so they end up replicating this relational rupture because of their behaviors. And part of it is, as you mentioned, David, when you said they're going to test you, that's whether it's conscious or unconscious, that's exactly what's happening. These kids will try to replicate familiar styles of relational engagement, and ultimately they are testing whether or not this is a connection that's going to be enduring and something that they can really trust. And the truth is, most of the time, these kids are better at pushing us away than we are at being patient. So I have to take my hat off to the therapist at the Hope Center and to the Hamiltons for being present and sticking with this, because that's, in the end, that's what will make the difference. And then once that sense of safety is created, as Diana was talking about, then you can do the real work. And fortunately, you can frequently make rapid progress once you've gotten to that point.
Diana Ochoa-Johnson at the Children's Shelter San Antonio. Is this a familiar pattern? Children come and then they really try to test the system. They see, oh, really, am I that safe? Or really, you love me? Let me put that to the test.
Oh, absolutely. We see this all the time. And in this particular case, as you mentioned, we're fortunate that the Hamiltons have continued to bring their child back into therapy, and that, over time, just with that consistency, they've had that breakthrough. Unfortunately, with many of the children that we do see at the Hope Center, often we don't have control over their placements, and so they do intend to get moved. And we also see exactly what was described before, is that families will sometimes take these children in, with every good intention, but the behavior just becomes too difficult for them, and they give up, unfortunately, before they reach that point. So I think it's so important for the listeners out there, and just anyone who's dealing with a child that maybe has had some trauma, is to find out more about it, educate yourself, and ask, where they can get that appropriate help. Because otherwise it's going to be that revolving door of going, to therapists or just wherever they go for help, that's just not going to be effective because they don't understand, the importance of just kind of sticking with it until they get to that healthy place.
There is a conference coming up here on May 10th and 11th at the St. Anthony, the South Texas Trauma-Informed Care Conference, building a multidisciplinary network of trauma-informed care in South Texas. There's going to be more information about that on our website. Our conversation continues. We do want to ask you, have you ever seen these signs? Have you experienced a childhood trauma? How did you cope in your life, or how did you help someone cope in their life and come back from that point of unpredictability to establish stable, beneficial patterns of behavior? And often people slip into substance abuse and other coping mechanisms. What else can we do to try to help individuals, these children especially? 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this quick break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davis. There is research that shows us that children, when they witness traumatic events like domestic violence, shootings, or they experience food or housing insecurity, there is a physical impact on brain growth. What are these neurological impacts? What are the effects of trauma and neglect? How can these signs and patterns of stress be identified in children? What evidence-based treatment to target this trauma specifically? And what kind of care can be found here in San Antonio? We invite you to call in with the questions and comments, 210-614-8980, as we talk about the impact of trauma on young brains. So let me ask Dr. Bruce Perry about when we talk about trauma, what are we talking about?
That's a laugh, because I've just been involved in a big federal project that's developing curriculum for families like the Hamiltons who are taking children into their home. And one of the big issues is, how do we define trauma so that everybody's on the same page? As everybody who's listening knows, we use that term all the time. But one of the useful ways of thinking about trauma is to think about the three E's. You know, there are events that are that could be a trauma, could cause traumatic impact. It's like a school shooting or witnessing domestic violence. But we also know that not everybody who is in the same event has the same experience. So you want to think about what's the experience of the person in that event. So somebody who's in a house fire, who is asleep and is carried out by the firemen and wakes up after, you know, everything's done, is not going to have the same experience as somebody who sees the flame start, smells the smoke, feels their life threatening, being threatened, and so forth. And so that's the second E, what's the real experience of the individual during the event. And then third one is the effects, the long-term effects. And we've been talking about some of them. Different people have different long-term effects that they carry around. So trauma basically is an experience or a pattern of experiences that ends up influencing the way a person's stress response functions and influences it in a way that it does not return back to normal, so that it changes it in some way, typically for the worse.
I want to push back, maybe ask some questions here about your definition about the experience. And you brought up this story of the child sleeping through the fire. But we've seen from examples of people who have PTSD, they may not actually have been in a combat zone, but still they suffer from PTSD because they still have some level of stress and exposure. And it's not really your direct experience, but it's your perception of your experience. And that person may not have the chronological narrative in their brain of going through that fire, but they know they were there and they saw the destruction. So you don't even have to be a direct witness of a traumatic event to suffer the trauma.
Exactly. And this is why that when scientists are trying to define trauma for research purposes, this becomes an issue. So, for example, many of you know about children who have autism. One of the characteristics of children with autism is that they have a very difficult time with sensory complexity. So a typical classroom day that somebody who's neurotypical, doesn't have autism, they can handle the transitions and the challenges and the birthday party that might be celebrated in the class, and they'll be fine. But for a child with autism who has this incredibly sensitized system, they may find that so overwhelming as to become a traumatic event. And again, this is one of the things that we're trying to better understand, that we have so much research that we need to do to characterize this. But the point you made earlier is very, very, very true and very important, because many, probably the majority of people who have trauma-related changes in their brain and body don't have a big catalog of these really bad events. In fact, as you mentioned in your introduction, food insecurity, housing insecurity, employment insecurity, and the way that's contagious in the household of a young child is literally able to create the same physiological changes in the stress responses as a set of major capital T trauma, like physical abuse, exposure to combat, and so forth. So if you look at the number of kids that are in a classroom, for example, who have trauma-related issues, the majority of them are going to have that because of these little t traumas that are chaos, unpredictability, uncertainty, and so forth.
Let's go to the phone lines. Number is 210-614-8980. Richard has called in. Richard, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just would like to know if you have these numbers available. How many professionals are out there in Bexar County who practice cognitive-based therapy, who have specific training in trauma-based therapy, who are licensed to practice trauma-based therapy within Bexar County, and where can we get the a list of these professionals, and do they in fact take Medicaid?
All right, Richard, thank you for the call. So let me go to Diana Ochoa. She's the Chief Clinical Officer for the Children's Shelter of San Antonio. She may not be able to answer directly about how many people there are and whether or not they'll take Medicaid. That's, you know, I mean, come on, try and figure out Medicaid and getting trauma therapy at all is going to be difficult. That'll give you trauma trying to figure that out. But, you know, what help is there available here in San Antonio?
Well, I can tell you that we have five therapists at the Hope Center who are all trained in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, and we do accept Medicaid. Another agency that I know has a number, but I don't know quite how many, is ChildSafe. They're another organization that also has made that investment in getting their therapists trained in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. And the third thing that I would suggest is getting on the website. If you just Google TFCBT, you can pull up a list of the therapists in your area that have that training and that certification.
And so we have the Harvey Najim Hope Center, and Harvey Najim is a philanthropist here in San Antonio, big giver.
Yes.
And he started this one. There's a second one opening up this summer in 2018, so that we'll be providing more care, right?
That's right, yes. Through the generosity of Mr. Najim, he...
Najim.
Yeah. So he gave us the seed money to open up the first Hope Center 3 years ago, and the need has just been tremendous. I mean, we have served probably about 800 children already in just 3 years, and so we were able to ask and receive some additional assistance from him to expand. And so we are opening what we're going to call our Hope Center 2 later this summer. We'll be able to hire additional therapists for that center as well.
Now the caller, this is Izara. Izara, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a retired university professor, and I have worked in early childhood, and I am so happy to hear this becoming so much more talked about than it has been. My question or my observation, what I've been hearing so far has focused a lot on external factors. And one of the pieces that I think is important is the role of attachment and the role it plays both in the experience of trauma and in the healing of trauma. And so I was wondering if that could be addressed.
All right. So let me go to Bruce Perry. Dr. Bruce Perry, can you talk about attachment?
Absolutely. I didn't. If you heard the portion of the segment earlier, one of the things I talked about was the importance of relationships. And as you well know, the fundamental capacity to form a healthy relationship and maintain it is related to your attachment capabilities, which have their origins early in life. And so it's interesting. I've been in this field for a long time. We never used to use the buzzword or the phrase trauma-informed. I actually tend not to like it because I think that it is too limiting. And I think one of the areas where it's profoundly limited is it doesn't have a fundamentally developmental perspective. It doesn't usually incorporate good formulations and stuff about attachment. So I appreciate your comments. But one of the things that we've done over the last 25 years is we've developed a broad network of clinicians who are working with at-risk kids, and we've now got about 50,000 children who have been assessed in the same way, and they're from all over the world. And one of the things that we've done is look at their history of relational health and their history of adversity, bad things. And we've looked at it at different times in life. And basically the most pervasive conclusion is this, is that the best predictor of how you're functioning in the present is not your history of adversity. It's not your ACEs. It's your history of relational connectedness. And every age group we look at and every historical pattern that we look at, it's the same thing. And again, this speaks to your comment about attachment. And I think that as the, quote, trauma-informed movement matures, it will start to incorporate that appreciation because it really is a fundamental component of this broader picture, and I think it needs to be emphasized quite a bit.
So when you say someone's history of relational attachments, are you talking about like how strong your family is?
That's part of it. what we look at is connection, is sort of connection within the family. Are you connected to community? Are you connected to a set of beliefs? And so there's a number of things that you can develop attachment to, depending upon your culture and your personal history and so forth.
These are all grounding mechanisms that a person can draw upon when dealing with all of this turmoil. We're going to talk more about that and more. The phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about the impact of trauma on children and even grown-up children that we call adults, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The importance of that first year and how we can help children into the future. Give us a call, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the impact of trauma on children and their brain development. With us on the line is Dr. Bruce Perry, and he wrote the book, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, and he is an expert, a global expert, on trauma in children and adults. So, Dr. Perry, let me ask you about that first year. If that first year can be relatively calm and stable and without a lot of upset, how beneficial is that?
You know, it's astoundingly powerful. It's almost as if it's an inoculation against future adversity. And I say that because, again, with this large sample of children that we've looked at, one of the things that we saw that was probably most surprising was that if a child does have a first year that where there's consistent, predictable, nurturing relationships and there are minimal life challenges, minimal adversities, but then the child ends up with 10, 12 years of significant adversity, that child will actually do better than a child who had the first year where there's chaos and threat and then the next 10 years where there's attention, healthy relationships, no adversity, and so forth. And so it's not the number, it turns out that people sort of focus on the number of bad things that happen, but what's probably more important is when the bad things happen and whether or not there were buffers, with these relational buffers that you mentioned earlier that are present.
Okay, I'm going to go to a caller. This is Rachel. And Rachel, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I was abused as a child, starting as 1 year old, from my mother. Constant abuse, constant moving, constant confusion, telling me that I should have been an abortion. When I was 7 years old, molested by her boyfriend at 7 years old, stayed with him for 3 more years. It never stopped. I was 15 years old. I finally ran away. I was going to be 16 that summer. Thank God I had a girlfriend. Her mother and father took me in, or God only knows what would have happened to me.
And so, Rachel, do you think that you were able to come back from that terrible early childhood and develop a more stable life pattern based upon the new relationships that you received?
It was always there haunting me, you know, as I grew up trying to be a good wife, a good mother, but it was always there haunting me, you know. I don't want to do this to my children, what was done to me, you know. It's just, I hear these stories of children being abused here in San Antonio. It breaks my heart, you know. What are they going through? Who can help them? Who can save them? You know, where is the answer for these children to be saved and to be helped and become productive citizens with coming from all this abuse?
Rachel, thank you for the call. So let me ask Dr. Bruce Perry about public policy using this information that we know will provide better outcomes in education, better outcomes in reduced need for support systems and expense in the criminal justice system and other areas. I mean, are we putting this science to work?
Well, we're starting to. And the interesting thing is there are different communities have taken this information and acted on it in different ways. So there are, for example, in the state of Washington, they have had for many years significant public policy focus on understanding the impact of adversity, creating trauma-informed schools, integrating ACE surveillance into their public health model, and they're, you know, they've had some significant positive effects of that. And then there are other county-based examples of that in California, for example, where they have really focused a lot on early childhood, integrating the learnings about trauma and so forth. And then there are other places that are a little bit further behind. But I think globally, the awareness of these issues is growing, and the creation of developmentally informed and trauma-informed policy and practice is following. But again, one of the really interesting things with getting old is that you realize that you can have a lot of great ideas and good science in the laboratory, but it takes 10, 15, sometimes 20 years to get that learning out into the public consciousness and awareness. And this is kind of what's happening. You know, those things that we were learning 25 and 30 years ago are now just becoming common knowledge in multiple disciplines. And I think we'll see significant positive policy changes. But they're not quite there yet.
So Ryan and Michelle Hamilton, the caregivers for those two young men that you've taken into your home. And so I want to ask you about school and how's that, that usually that's where you see some conflicts and it's difficult to, how has that been working out for you?
Well, for Alex, the school has been kind of rough. I mean, he's had a few cases where he's been not so good with others, and he likes to go hang out with those to trigger him, to make him want to be aggressive. And then as soon as he gets that trigger, he gets aggressive and he doesn't know when to stop. And so that's really a big problem for him.
We have him on a IEP.
What is that?
It's a individual...
education plan.
Education plan. It's a behavioral one. So it kind of, the teachers know, everyone's well aware of what can happen and what to do in specific situations. So that's been very helpful. We've kind of put that in place after the first year when he's starting to show some more aggressiveness and stuff. So that's been very helpful.
And so school, the Dr. Perry is where, you know, we put our children, and they're exposed to a lot of stressors, and they can either act out or build that resilience.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the major targets of a community's development of trauma-informed practice should be the school. And it is sadly one of the places where there's still a lot of misunderstanding about these children's behavior. Rather than understanding that it's fear-based or trauma-based, they think it's intentional or predatory. And the misunderstanding between the educators and the students leads to more conflict. But the good news is that when these concepts are brought into schools, you can see tremendous changes in outcomes. We, for example, in Columbus, where we have been working for a long time, had a school, an elementary school, where only 5% of the children in the third grade were achieving the state standards. And after 1 year of this teaching about these trauma concepts, the percentage went up to 58%. So that's a huge positive increase in academic achievement. And at the same time, suspensions went almost to zero. So critical incidents, restraints, suspensions dropped significantly. Academic output went up. And this is something that we've seen in our partner schools in Alberta, Tasmania, Scotland, and probably 15 different states throughout the U.S. And again, once the educators understand this, they make some very creative changes in the way they choose to educate these kids and handle episodes of where they explode and so forth. And it leads to much better outcomes.
But it's at school where it's where we see the achievement gap, because children who experienced high trauma, who were never received any treatment or therapy, they're the ones that are going to fall behind. They come from at-risk environments, troubled homes, and then they've had that problem, the arrested brain development, and are not really able to get where they need to go with other children. So you can't really protect all children from this, but probably what we can do is have more awareness of these how to deal with it in school and across society?
Well, I think that you're pointing out the relationship between trauma and the achievement gap is spot on. That the achievement gap is about the stress response or these threat-related changes in the body and brain shutting down to some degree, the learning parts of the brain. And so children can sit in a wonderful lecture that's got perfect curriculum by a great teacher, and a child who's had a history of trauma won't learn very well, and a child who has no history of trauma will learn the content really quickly. And so over time, that leads to this achievement gap. And the good news is that if you can regulate these kids, if you can identify them and provide regulatory interventions, their capacity to learn begins to approximate the rate of kids who have not had trauma, so they can catch up.
And so and let me ask you a quick question, though, as we run out of time here. The children who do receive therapy and receive treatment, are they likely to have regression, or do they build resilience and be able to take on more adapted to trauma in the future?
In general, kids that have effective therapy develop some component of resilience and are able to deal with future stressors in a better way. But that, as was talked about earlier, the therapeutic process can be very, very long. The good news that we've seen is that actually most therapeutic change takes place outside of therapy. Mm-hmm. That most therapeutic healing comes
right.
from
in
family,
home?
School, home, exactly. And that if just like the moment by moment interactions that the Hamiltons are providing for these boys are providing as much positive therapeutic impact as the therapy hour.
Wow. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Bruce Perry. His book is The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. He is a psychiatrist, international trauma expert, senior fellow at the Child Trauma Academy. Also with us, Diana Ochoa-Johnson at the Children's Shelter San Antonio. Thank you so much to Ryan and Michelle Hamilton as caregivers, and good luck to you guys. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.